This is Listening to the Dead.
Uncovering the secrets of forensics today.
I'm Linda LaPlante, novelist, producer, writer of 150 hours of TV and 33 crime novels. And truthfully, I don't think one could have been completed without the assistance of the police, especially my close friend Cass Sutherland.
Hi, I'm Cass Sutherland, former detective and CSI in the Metropolitan Police Force.
This is episode 4, Forensic Entomology.
Which is a study of how insects and bugs interact with dead bodies. At times it sounds like something out of a horror movie, but it's a vital part of many police investigations, giving clues as to the time of death and whether a body might or might not have been moved.
I remember when I first came across entomology used in a crime scene was actually so far back before I wrote Prime Suspect, and I was working with two Met police officers who had been involved in a very, very unpleasant case. And one of them said, "Oh, we've actually got it on film. Do you want to see it?" So I really had never been to a crime scene. I had never, ever been to an autopsy at that point. Nothing. I said, "Oh, thank you very much." And they gave me this video, and it was the discovery of an 18-year-old boy on the side of a railway track. And it's just rather amateur filming, and I'm watching it, and you can actually physically see the police officers heading towards this body that is laid out, and this black cloud suddenly appeared up from the body, and I couldn't believe what it was. It's flies. They were like a kind of seething mass. And that was the first time anybody said to me, we're going to get an entomologist along here because he'll be able to see how long this boy's been dead. Never, ever forgot it. That was the first time I really even heard the word entomology.
I had a similar experience in that we had a young girl, teenage girl, a few days before her 16th birthday who'd been murdered and dumped on wasteland. And it was actually a forensic scientist who was looking at the scene for us who said, "Have you ever heard of forensic entomology?" And at that time I hadn't, because it was a brand new science. In that case, I actually submitted the maggots and the larvae to the Natural History Museum, which is where I met our next guest, Dr. Martin Hall, a forensic entomologist. I'm standing in the Great Hall of the Natural History Museum underneath a 25-metre skeleton of the great blue whale. And I'm waiting to meet Dr. Martin Hall, who's head of the Life Sciences, Parasites and Vectors Division here at the museum. That title's a bit of a mouthful, but basically what he does, he's a forensic entomologist and probably one of the leading ones in this country. Forensic entomology is the study of bugs and insects, and it helps the police investigating dead bodies and corpses that are found in the wild and sometimes in premises. Might all sound a bit grim, but it's a vital part of police investigation. So let's go meet him. Hello, Martin. Great to see you. Thank you for having me along.
Morning,
today.
Chris. Good to see you. Well, let's go along to my office just upstairs here now, and I've got some specimens you can have a look at there.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Great.
Martin, I think I'm right in thinking that you've been researching general entomology here at the Natural History Museum for 30 years now. But how and when did you first get into the actual forensics and crime scene side of things?
Right, yeah, as that's true. I've been at the museum for just over 30 years now. And when I first joined, there was a chap called Ken Smith who worked at the museum. He was basically my predecessor. and he retired about a year or so after I joined. Just before I joined the museum, he'd actually published a book called The Manual of Forensic Entomology, and this was the first book on the subject, really, that brought together a widely scattered literature and made it accessible to scientists. And really, it was a massive stimulus to research on the subject. If you look at a number of publications on forensic entomology after Ken's book, there's almost an exponential rise. Ken, though, wasn't so keen on going to crime scenes and so forth. And, of course, when he retired, there was no one to take his place. So the police started asking me if I would be able to contribute in this way. And my background was in veterinary entomology. I studied tsetse flies for many years in Africa. And when I came to the museum, I actually started out studying blowflies that don't hang around and wait for you to die. They'll infest you while you're still living. It's a disease called miasis. It's a problem with humans, but mainly actually with animals, and particularly in the tropics. But those blowflies are related to the blowflies that develop on dead bodies. In fact, they can be the same ones. So it wasn't such a big switch for me from veterinary entomology to forensics, because I was already working on those sort of insects.
What was the first crime you actually got involved in or called to, and how did you work that crime scene? Because when the police first called you, it must have been as new to them, your forensic discipline, as you were to a crime scene.
Yeah, to be quite honest, for me it was a real plunge into the deep end, because I was called to go to a scene where a body had been found. It was actually a skeletonized body. And the question the police want to know is, how long had that body been dead for? That's the question I'm asked in probably three quarters of the cases I get called to. And but I hadn't had no training in actually applying my theoretical knowledge. And I'd never seen a dead body before. This is my first trip to a crime scene. And I'd had actually no instruction on what to do. So it was almost like making it up as you go along. It was a real baptism of fire. I generally attend murders, and I've worked on well over 200 cases now. And so, going back to the basics, why do we even look at insects at all? Insects are ubiquitous in the environment. They're around the whole time. And, you know, there's often that quote, you know, I'd love to have been a fly on the wall. Well, actually, there usually are flies on the wall. And they then get involved with the body that's lying there. And so your job as a forensic entomologist is to interpret what they're telling you about that scene. Blowflies are the gold standard. They generally arrive at a body most rapidly. So they then lay their eggs. And as they lay their eggs, the eggs are fertilised. And so the egg starts to develop, and basically a biological clock starts ticking. And it's my job to work out how long that clock's been ticking for. So we need to collect our insects off the body. You might think that's a simple process. But sometimes it's difficult to recognise what it is, an insect. We've got some maggots on the table in front of
us
here.
And I should say that they're alive and moving. Thankfully not on the table, but in a jar on the table.
Absolutely, they won't escape, we'll guarantee that. But you can see that there are some moving around quite actively. There are others, though, other things in the pot that just look like seeds of a plant. They're not moving at all. They're actually called puparia. That's what the larva will turn into. It'll metamorphose into that puparium. And the adult fly will actually emerge from that, essentially it's like a cocoon. But it's made from the skin of the last maggot as it contracts and hardens. And I've been sent maggots that have been beautifully preserved by police before from a crime scene which I couldn't go to. And, of course, I could age those maggots and identify them. But when the police sent me the crime scene photos, I could see around the body there were these puparia. They hadn't been collected because they're not wriggling around, so there wasn't known that they were insects. They obviously were older than the maggots on the body. So basically the oldest evidence, which would have given you a better time of death had been overlooked, and in fact the flat was, you know, had a deep clean before any of that evidence was collected. So it is important to be aware of the life cycle of insects, you know, so that you can collect them in the best manner. So what you need to do, as seen, is take along a flask of water, or hot water this is, or if you haven't got any, you need to pop along to a McDonald's and ask if you can borrow some hot water into your flask. And to kill the maggots, you basically just immerse them in hot water for about 30 seconds. And this stretches them out and kills off any bacteria, fixes the tissues, so they end up, you know, beautiful, nice white maggots.
How does it actually help you to narrow down how long that body's been there or time of death?
Well, basically what you're trying to do is establish which are the oldest specimens, we can then work out how old they are, basically by knowing about their life cycle. At many institutes around the world, and indeed at the museum as well, we have in our tower, which you can see out the window here, lovely sort of Gothic tower, but at the top there we have an insectary with incubators, and we can rear specimens at different temperatures. And the temperature is really important because, unlike us, you know, we develop at a set rate. So whether you're an Eskimo or living on the equator, you basically develop at the same rate. For a fly developing in the North Pole, it would develop much slower than the ones on the equator because they're called poikilothermic or cold-blooded. So I've got a couple of little jars of maggots here. And, you know, if you ask people which ones are the oldest, they'll obviously look at the big ones and say, well, it must be those. Actually, they're both the same age. They're 2 days old. It's just that the smaller ones grew at 21 degrees centigrade and the bigger ones at 26 degrees centigrade. So only a 5-degree difference, but it's made an enormous difference to their size. That's basically what we do. And once you've established how old the insects are, the oldest insects on the body, that gives you an idea of how long that body's been there. Because, you know, unless it was infested before death, then the flies will only arrive at or after death. And blowflies can find a body really quickly. So in the summer, they can be landing on the body within just hours, maybe even minutes after death.
What attracts them to a decomposing body to a dead body? Why does a fly go?
Yeah, good question. I mean, flies are curious things, so they land on us the whole time. They're irritating things. When we're alive, we can brush them off. But obviously, when we die, we can't do that, and they'll go on and investigate you. And, of course, as we decompose quite rapidly after death, we begin to decompose due to the bacteria in us and environmental bacteria. We begin to smell, decompose, and there's lots of chemicals given off. And the flies are much better able to detect those odours than we are. So flies can find a body very quickly because they are much better able to detect odours of decomposition than we can.
What about movement of a body? Say somebody who's been murdered in a house and kept there for a while and then been moved. I'm led to believe that sometimes there's different types of flies that you would only get in certain areas. Can you determine if there's an unusual, you think, well, that fly shouldn't be here?
Yes, I mean, it's more difficult over small distances, but over bigger distances. So, for example, there are blowflies that live in Scotland that don't occur in the south of England. Insects can be really useful in terms of the seasonality. Some insects occur only in the winter, some only in the summer. So, for example, I worked on one body that was found in Scotland in February, an elderly gentleman, and because it was the winter and decomposition was quite slow, the pathologist really couldn't give any idea of when the person died. But there was a species of fly on the body which is not active in February. There were large larvae. So for them to have got on the body, they must have been deposited by flies that were active in the previous year, that probably disappear around the end of October, that sort of period. But that meant the police could look at that time frame rather than, looking at the year in which we found the body.
You mentioned earlier, Martin, about the skeletonised body where there's just bone left. What are you looking for there?
Well, what you could be looking for there, I mean, by that stage, the first colonisers, the blowflies, have long since come and gone. And you might only be able to say that, well, you know, we've had one generation's worth on there, so that's in the summer, 2 to 3 weeks. So what we'd be looking for there would be other insects that have come in, often at later stages of decomposition. And here you're entering the world of, you can almost say the murky world of succession, because as bodies decompose, they give off different smells and different flies are attracted to those. And to be honest, this is an area where there are massive opportunities for more research, because actually timing those later arrivals is much more difficult. But there is good progress being made, particularly in Poland, in forests in Poland, where studies have been done looking at the arrival of different types of beetles. And in this cabinet here, we have a few different beetles down here. So they, some of those will be feeding on the body, but some of them will be feeding on the maggots that are on the body. So obviously they will arrive after the maggots have got there. But there is promising data that shows that using succession, we can be a little bit more precise in the future than we have been up to now. There's lots of research going on at the moment on the chemicals on the bodies of the puparia, because often at a crime scene, what you'll find is empty puparia. You know the flies have emerged, but you don't know when they emerged. But there are hopes there are chemicals on the skin called cuticular hydrocarbons, and they change in composition over time. And it might be possible in the future to be able to say how long it has been empty, that puparium.
Essentially, I had a case once where it was a badly decomposed body in the middle of summer on a bed. And at first, when we looked at there was window and neck curtains, it looked like it was blood spray all over it.
Oh, right.
But what it was in the end was the flies had been landing on the body, then flying to the light, and where they'd hit the white neck curtain, it left what looked like dried old blood stains, but it wasn't blood at all, and it was a natural cause of death.
Absolutely. Those fly specks are commonly mistaken for blood spatter because they look exactly the same. A pathologist sent me some pictures of a man who died, and his face had these spots all over it, and the police thought that this was blood spatter from a violent assault with a knife, but actually they were it's basically excrement and vomit from flies that have been feeding on blood on the wound, and then they moved up to the face to actually investigate it to lay their eggs, and they defecate and produce these little spots which are essentially blood that's partially digested, and they just look like blood spatter.
We have dogs, sniffer dogs, we have blood dogs, we have drugs dogs, even banknote dogs, and dogs for sniffing out dead bodies. But if flies are so easily attracted to bodies, could we ever use flies or some form of insect in that way to try and trace a body, a missing body?
I mean, that's certainly possible, and that would be my dream for the future for, you know, some young aspiring forensic entomologists to develop. Already there are little radio transponders that you can put onto hornets and track their movements. They probably weigh just a little bit too much for a fly at the moment, but we're going in the right direction. So you could see a future where you have a colony of flies and you have flies that are ready to lay their eggs. These are the ones that are most acutely sensitive to the odours of decomposition and will want to be looking for a body so they can lay their eggs on it. So you could imagine fitting these with a little radio transmitter, releasing them in a woodland, for example, and then tracking where they go. That would be great.
If you had no body somewhere, but it was quite clear that there had been one, could you get the DNA from what the flies of whatever the fly's eaten?
Yeah, you can indeed. I mean, the maggots are what they've eaten, basically. So they ingest human DNA. And so there have been cases in Italy where the mafia have removed a body, but they've left loads of maggots crawling around. And they've been actually, they were still alive, the maggots, and were able to get human DNA from them, even cases in the UK where there actually weren't any maggots, just empty puparia and no body at all. The police weren't even searching this place for a body, but they were suspicious and they sent these empty puparia off for analysis. Firstly, drugs analysis. They got down the breakdown products of drugs. So obviously they hadn't been feeding on a dead pigeon or something. And they got a 75% match with a known missing drug user. And so the insects were able to indicate the death, even though there wasn't a body right there.
Where do you see the future of forensic entomology going?
Well, as I said, I think there are so many avenues for young scientists to follow. One of the ones that we've kicked off at the museum is using micro CT scanning. Just like you'd scan a patient in a hospital, you can scan a fly. What we've been scanning is fly puparia. So I've got a bunch of puparia in a jar here. And the thing about blowfly puparia is they're opaque. You can't see what's going on inside there except by destructive opening them up. But if you put them in a CT scanner, you can get amazing resolution of all the organs developing. And what we've been able to do so far is get down to 10% time intervals. And in the summer, that's to the nearest day. So CT scanning would be a great tool for the future as CT scanners become more and more commonly used for getting this precision in aging the insects.
Martin, it's been fascinating. I mean, who would have thought that flies and other insects could actually help so much in criminal investigation? From years ago in my day, I remember people taking maggots off bodies simply for going fishing.
Right.
But little did we ever know that in all those years to come.
Probably ethically a bit dubious.
Times would change. Thank you very much for your time. It's been very interesting and thoroughly enjoyable.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I think that was absolutely fascinating. I'm astonished that Martin is hopeful of finding a way to track fly movements and use them as sniffer flies. I mean, it sort of defies belief. I mean, hush, hush, but I will be using that.
It's amazing to me how all these different forensic disciplines we're looking at are all sort of intertwined. I mean, like a forensic entomologist can go to the scene, a blood pattern analyst. I mean, there's so many people in that world who can give you such critical evidence in a major crime investigation.
I know. For me, I very rarely take what I call dramatic license. If I have somebody as prestigious as Martin, and he says, oh, no, that fly came out of the body at 2:15, you know, you can't get a result, then I wouldn't put it in, because the expertise is so fascinating. What we've had over the years is really a lot of drama productions that know absolutely nothing about the scientific side, are not really interested in getting the authenticity right. For me, it actually makes the drama. People are fascinated. The scientific advances we have today are absolutely phenomenal. And just to have somebody like this professor talking about thinking of having a fly tracking, it is wonderful, wonderful. God bless him. You know what else I found absolutely fascinating is that we've spoken in forensic about the importance of the scene of the crime. And as you said, you know, don't open a window, shut the window, don't do anything. So in a case where the maggots were over the cadaver, they took in the maggots. But to me, the fascinating part was he hadn't brought in the puparia, the shell of the maggot. You can only imagine what would go on is when he goes, yes, well, where are the shells? Well, we didn't think we had to bring them in. We've got the maggots. No, I want the shells. And here you have the scientific brilliance from the shells, the science and the information that can be cleaned from them is beyond belief. And this is where I think we will be hearing an awful lot more from Martin. Probably, I may be actually stealing some of his ideas in my latest novels.
What you said there actually kind of like harps back to what we've raised in most of the conversations we've had with different forensic experts is probably one of the reasons that they didn't submit the right things was because they hadn't been either properly trained in it or weren't aware of Martin's discipline. Or certainly the benefits had they got on a phone right away and said, excuse me, we think we have a crime scene that you might be able to help us with.
Yeah, you're so right. Yeah, and this is why I'm sure listeners are going to be so fascinated, because they won't know about it either. And they'll be a bit like me. I mean, you're all, you know, professional and you are very aware, but I've had to learn all along the way as a writer and a producer in scripts and filming. And it, to me, I could only have done it with the assistance of these brilliant people. And as I said earlier, they're still giving me plot lines.
I mean, they're all quite clearly under immense pressure, particularly from detectives. Even as a CSI, I found, as you know, as soon as you got there, they wanted to see this, they wanted to know that. They kind of saw you as the expert, and you've got information coming in from everywhere. But I used to say, I just need to make a quick phone call and go to the car, which gave me time to actually sit down and work out how I was going to deal with this scene. Because the problem is, if you go rushing in, you go in without actually thinking what you're going to deal with, then you destroy evidence, you end up with contamination. And I think all the expert scientists that we've heard from actually make that show how important it is to know what you're doing. You only get one chance. If you get it wrong, that's it. You've destroyed things.
Also, you know, the more I listen to the scientists, there is a quietness to them. Their professionalism, their studiousness, their dedication to getting it right, because as you just said, you can't get it wrong. That's terribly important, and it's a very, very different attitude almost to if you're watching some of the drug squad, the armed robberies that are going on. They're all very, very different. This is quietly, quietly catchy killer. And in a way, that is what has always fascinated me. The other officers, equally dependent on their specialist training, be they armed force, drug squads, but it is the scientists, the quiet, who are, truthfully, talking to the dead.
It's their impartiality as well, because that's they go by the evidence that they're presented with and they draw their conclusions from that evidence. And it's the impartiality that is so very good. And it must be hard for them. There are times that some scientists have alluded to when further information comes in a case and they're not given that information, which could actually totally change their sort of theories or their evidence. Because at the end of the day, people tend to think, well, you know, if the police don't get it right, the criminal's going to get off. Well, no, the innocent person might get convicted as well if you don't get it right. Yes, it's a lot better than it was, but there's still a long way to go. It's made me want to get my blue overalls and latex gloves out again and get back in a crime scene.
Not yet. No, you don't, Cass, because we've still got two more episodes to go. And the next one up, digital forensic.
I want to know what I call my victim. Okay, let's see what you're all about, Sunshine. So you have a little look at their photographs, you have a little look at their web browsing, little look at their documents, you have a little look at their email. All of that gives you an overview of what type of person this is, how educated they are, how they express themselves, how they feel about themselves in the real world, what impression they like to give the exterior world, which will be a completely different thing to how they feel about themselves. Their photographs will tell you what's dear to their hearts or the sorts of things that they're interested in. All the time you're doing that, you're building a profile, you're profiling the person.
Listening to the Dead is made in collaboration with Bonnier Books. Our producer is Chris Attaway. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening now, and a new episode will pop up in your feed every week. Until then, thanks for listening.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Listening to the Dead. My new novel, Buried, is out April 2nd, 2020, in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.